right, we are ready for chapters 17 and 18 of the book of Deuteronomy. This is the outline that we're following. We are in the second major section, the second sermon, if you will, where Moses is looking within. He's looking to the law. It's a review of the law. We'll get to that here in just a second. We're in the statutes section, where he is reminding them of some of the details of the statutes. For example, what's to be done with reference to a sacrifice. We'll start off with that at chapter 17. He'll talk about what you do with an idolater, how you identify an idolater, those kinds of principles, and here's how a king ought to behave. Here's our principles from the law, the Levites' portion, etc. That's part of these statutes. It's been a little while since we've seen this particular thing. This is not original with me, but divided by three speeches here, and we are here in the second speech, which is a review of the law. That's the primary function of this sermon. Where the first one was historical and ends on the note of obedience, this is a review of the law but emphasizes obedience. And every sermon does that, of the three or four, however you divide those. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. Review from Sinai to Kadesh. Very good. Chapter 2, since it's historical, that's what we're doing, reviewing. Chapter 2 was, the wilderness wanderings and victory over Sihon, which then leads us to chapter 3, victory over Og, yes, the division of the land and Moses forbidden to enter. Chapter 4 ends that first sermon on the note, the necessity of obedience. That's sermon 1. Starting sermon 2, chapter 5. The Ten Commandments and the people fear God. Chapter 6 gets a broader view of the law. Chapter 7. Chapter 6. You're good. You're right. Got ahead. All right. Yeah. The place of the warning and the meaning of the law. That's a broader view of the law. Now chapter 7, Dickie. Separate people. Yes. A separate people. Chapter 8. Coming back to that same point we saw in chapter 4. Emphasizing, driving that principle home. Chapter 9. Warning about pride and self-righteousness. You're going to enter the land, but it's not by your own doings and because you're good. Chapter 10. Mercy and obedience. It deals with that obedience again. He comes home and hits that principle again and again. You're going to hear that note. He's going to hit it time and again through the sermon. So chapter 11, he's ready to hit it again. Deals with love and obedience. Chapter 12. Why does chapter 12 stand out? And we keep talking about chapter 12. It is that chapter that talks about, there's a phrase that is used over and over. It's the place of worship, the place that God chooses. Why didn't he mention a name of a city? There's more than one. There will be Shiloh for a while. Then ultimately it's going to be Jerusalem. So remember chapter 12. We're going to see it again tonight. Chapter 13. All right. It deals with the same principle we're going to see in our chapter tonight concerning those who are given to idolatry. Same principle. Chapter 14 deals with. All right. Chapter 15, last week, the 7-year release. And then we have in chapter 16, the annual feast. All right. What is chapter, question number, whatever it is, one. What is chapter 17 all about? All right. Yes. Deals with sacrifice, deals with idolaters, and deals with a king, king's behavior. Those three things, actually four things, are dealt with here in this context. All right. Let's go to question two. How could you harmonize the instructions of chapter 17, 2 through 7, with the command not to kill of Deuteronomy 5 and 7, which is a quotation of the Ten Commandments, by the way? All right, difference in motive, difference in punishment. Anything else? All right, civil government It was established to punish the evildoer. All through the Old Testament, New Testament as well, but the principle of capital punishment is established, starting in Genesis 9, showing respect for life. Capital punishment is connected with respect for life, not disrespect for life. And so it is not in the capital punishment is not in disarray with any command, thou shalt not kill. The command to execute the evildoer, like in Deuteronomy 17, has to do with civil action, the punishment of the evildoer, where Deuteronomy 5 forbids the killing without a cause. Does that make sense? Not all killing is put in the category of murder of Deuteronomy chapter 5 in Exodus 20. All right, question number 3. What's to be done with hard legal cases? Take it to the priest and to the Levites. They're at the place where God chooses. Let's start with this sacrifice to the Lord the best. Just one verse devoted to this. This is not a new principle. We have seen this before, time and time again. Remember, much of what Moses is doing in Deuteronomy is reviewing, thus, the second giving of the law, which is what Deuteronomy means. It's really a re-emphasis of the law. The law is not being given again. It's the re-emphasis of the law on the eve of crossing over into the land of Canaan. So there's a need to remind them of what they already know. So much of his preaching, if you were there listening, you're going to think, I've already heard this. There's some new information, but most of it you've heard before. And it's a review, and he's emphasizing something again. So here we go, verse 1. That you shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or a sheep or anything with blemish or defect, for that's an abomination to the Lord. What does that tell you? That's all he says here. He says more in other places. What does that verse tell you? Lord demands the best. Good point. Remember there was a statement, I will not give to the Lord that costs something that costs me nothing. Maybe it was Abraham made that statement. And so here's the idea of giving a sacrifice. I'll sacrifice to the Lord, but this lamb is blemished, or this one is lame, or this one is going to die anyway. Let me give that one to the Lord. That's not much of a sacrifice, but here the Lord demands the best. Don't give anything to the Lord that has any blemish or defect. So in other words, sacrifice to the Lord the best. The Lord is first and foremost. Now that has some connection with everything else, in that if the Lord's first and foremost, you're giving him the best, then you're not going to be given to idolatry, and you're going to follow his plan. Let's talk about killing the idolater. There's some very practical things to learn here. We're not going to be, it's doubtful you're going to ever find a fellow Christian or brother or sister in the Lord caught up in idolatry as per this idolatry here in this context. You may see someone given to covetousness. And it's not likely that you're going to be reporting them to someone and then you're going to stone them. It's not likely going to happen, but there are some practical things here. Verses 2 to 4, actually. What do we see about the idolater? It could be that someone among you, man or a woman, has done wickedness in the sight of the Lord. Verse 3 identifies that wickedness as transgressing the covenant and have gone after other gods and worship them, and it might include the sun, the moon, worshiping the sun and the moon or the stars, verse 3, or the host of heaven, which I did not command. I learned a lesson about authority from that verse. If God didn't command it, then it's not authorized. You stay away from it if it's not commanded of God. Did God forbid idolatry? Sure he did, but he didn't have to. He just didn't command it. That's enough. But that's not all. Look at verse 4. And it was told you, and you hear of it, then what do you do? You ask questions. You inquire diligently.
If indeed it is true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, then we're ready for verse 5. We'll get to that in a moment. All right, what do we just learn from verse 1 to 4? It's possible that one of your own goes astray. They may go so far as to worship idolatry. You get a report of that. This is where I'm headed. You search out and find out if it's true. You gather and get all the facts. You don't get on the bandwagon. He needs to be stoned. We need to do it, and we need to do it today because he's guilty of idolatry when you don't know if it's true or not. You just heard a report of that. You want to get all the facts together. Anything practical in that? All right, we've got to have some witnesses. We'll talk about that in verses 5 to 7. Yeah, don't always believe the first thing you hear. Proverbs 18, verse 13. Proverbs 18, 17. He that is first to defend his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. Those principles come to play. Don't believe every report you hear. Don't get ready to mark someone off when you heard a bad report. It may not be true. Get the facts together. And very good. All right, let's look at 5 to 7 here. Stone him to death. This is the result or the punishment that you should bring him out of your gate, that man or woman that's committed wickedness. We've seen this principle before. And stone him to death, that man or woman with stones. And if he's worthy of death, you put him to death on the testimony of what? And he shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. So he goes back to the principle of searching out the evidence. Now look at verse 7. The hand of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death. That's new information, seemingly. I don't remember that. Maybe it was before. I don't remember that. What's that tell you? The hand of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward all the hands of the people shall put away that wicked person from among you. All right, yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's a good point. That's what I was fishing for here. That puts pressure on this witness to deal with the problem. Some people want to report a problem, but they don't want to be involved in dealing with the problem. X is guilty of XYZ. All right, go with us and we'll talk. No. Don't use my name. I'm not going to get involved in that. I'm just reporting to you, so you deal with that. If you're the witness, you're going to be the first one to raise his hand against him, then everybody else. That makes you kind of skittish of bringing a report up, unless you have some evidence. Make sure it's true. Do you have a hand up? Good point. Do you see a couple of measures in play to ensure that things are being done properly? And then we're going to move on because we got to get to some other things. But you don't just buy any report that comes along. There's some practical things for us in that, even though we're not under Old Testament law. And then when you get ready to execute the judgment, since you are a witness, you're going to be involved. So it makes you very careful to be a witness and blurting out, I want to tell you about a bad report. You don't want to give that unless you're going to stand. Don't stick the report out there until you're going to stand on it, is the principle. All right, now in verse 8 now, beginning, talks about dealing with hard legal cases. And I take it that let me summarize, then we'll work our way through 8 to 13, that in the towns, where once they're settled into the land, they're going to be far from the tabernacle, if it's at Shiloh, many are going to be many miles from that, that there would be judges in the various locales to settle their issues and their problems, but it may rise to a higher court. As in our case, you may go to the state Supreme Court, then you may go to the nation Supreme Court. Does that make sense? Same kind of principle here. So there's going to be some things that rise because of the difficulty. So beginning at verse 8 and 9, in difficult matters, you're going to go to the priest and to the Levites. In other words, you're going to go to the place where God chooses. We're going to see that. And that's that phrase we've been talking about, that in matters that rise too hard for you to judge and degrees of blood guiltiness. You know, there's some clear-cut cases, but there's degrees of blood guiltiness. Was this premeditated action, or was it in self-defense, or what is this blood guiltiness? Well, that may be a difficult case. Or in the judgment you're going to execute between one judgment or another. And if it arises, then you go to the place which the Lord God chooses. Deuteronomy chapter 12. All right. Deuteronomy 12. That's the place where God chooses. It may be Shiloh, maybe another location. Ultimately, it's going to be Jerusalem, as we've mentioned time and again. And you should come to the priest and to the Levites, and they'll judge. So they'll serve as a judgment and pronounce the judgment in the sentence. So you take it to a higher court. They decided down here it's too difficult. We carry it on up to the priest, so you go to Jerusalem for that. Now, what do we learn from 10 and 11? Yeah, you agree to abide by that. This is God's plan. God wants you to abide by that ruling. So you do, when they do according to their sentence, that God, I lost my place here. You shall do according to the sentence which they pronounce upon you in the place which the Lord chooses. There's our Deuteronomy 12. And then here's our word we watch for each time. You shall be careful to do according to all that they order you. So not only is that word careful used in direction toward God, God told you to do something, you be careful. God saying, I'm telling you to be careful to follow exactly what the judges tell you. So in following others' orders is part of following God's orders. Make sense? God wants us to be careful toward Him. He also wants us to be careful toward those that have some rule over us. Interesting words. Verse 11, according to the sentence of the law, that the judgment you shall do. And don't turn to the right hand of the lamp, or to the left. In other words, don't mess with their sentence. All right, 12 to 13. What do you see in 12 to 13? All right, the man who acts presumptuously and will not heed the priest, who stands to minister before the Lord, he shall die. God pretty severe in his punishment, wasn't he? And you put away that evil among you. And all the people shall hear, and what happens? Yeah, they're going to fear. There's a principle found here that I see in 1 Corinthians 5. I see it in 2 Thessalonians 3. I see it in Acts chapter 5. Why do I mention Acts 5? Go back to verse 13. The people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. Now, he won't because he's dead, but it's not talking about him not acting presumptuous. It's talking about others. Why? Yes. Absolutely. And verse 11 of chapter 5 talks about fear coming upon all. When they were dead and dropped dead because they lied, then people begin to tremble. You know what? It kind of makes me afraid to tell a lie. And the same thing here. So this was part of God's plan. When punishment was executed, it was intended not only for that person's punishment, for everybody else to learn from that. And you recognize that if you've got several kids. You punish one, the others begin to take heed that, you know what, I don't want to get caught doing the same thing. All right, let's talk about the king now. By the way, this word presumptuous, that's interesting. It's not that they are looking at God's rule and said, you know what, I'm not going to do what God says. He just doesn't obey what the priest and the Levites have ruled, and he's acting presumptuously. That's interesting. All right, let's talk about the king's behavior. Now, this is interesting because there's not a king, and there's not going to be a king for a while. And when they do demand a king, God says it was a rebellion against him. Isn't that interesting? So this is prophetic as well as stating law. So you might flag verse 14. Let's get verse 14, and we'll flag the passage that you know well. But you may not remember where it was. When you come into the land which the Lord God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. That is found in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now there's verse 5, verse 15, but chapter 8 will do it. The whole chapter is devoted to that. So the point at verse 14 is you're going to get into the land and eventually you're going to say, I want a king like all the other nations. And they did. They did. And 1 Samuel chapter 8 is where that took place. Now they had judges leading them. They weren't satisfied with that. They wanted to be like the others. And God foreknew that. So he's making plans. All right, verse 15, here's a rule. When you get a king, you're not to choose a king, you're not to have a king from that is a foreigner. Now, he doesn't tell us why here, but can you kind of figure out why based on one of the chapters we've already covered? Chapter, what'd you say? Yeah. Remember chapter 7, you are a separate people, and you're not to be like the nations. And we've already seen numerous times, don't follow after their practices, so you become like them, and you will become like them. If you intermarry the people, Deuteronomy 7 talks about that. So don't have a foreigner lead you. God's going to make the choice, but you're not to choose a foreigner to lead you because he'll lead you astray. Yes, ma'am. Exactly. All right, let's look at 16 and 17. What else do we know about this king? He shouldn't be self-serving, but submissive to the Lord, and he shouldn't lead astray. Now, notice the text talks about he shouldn't multiply horses for himself. Nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. What is the idea of multiplying horses? Was it a prohibition against having horses? It could have cattle, but couldn't have horses? It has to do with military strength. Yeah, and so he's not putting his trust in military strength with the number of horses and the horsemen and the cavalry that he might have. He's not putting his confidence in horses. Look at the force that we have. Look at the military that we have. So I know we're a strong nation. The king among God's people is going to recognize we're strong because we have our God and not because of our military strength. All right. So verse 16, you're not going to put confidence in horses, nor shall he return to Egypt. In other words, he's not going to lead them astray and carry them back. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself. Who's that sound like? Solomon. They did have a king that did that. Did they have kings that trusted in horses? Absolutely. What will happen if he multiplies wives for himself? Yeah, they will lead his heart away. So nor shall he multiply silver and gold for himself. That sounds like Solomon also. Didn't go well, did it? All right. So here's some rules with reference to him. Now, verses 18 to 20, I want us to spend a little time there. This king is going to read the law or should read the law, and he should fear God. So let's talk about what is to take place. Not every person had a scroll for themselves. They would often go to the public reading of the scriptures. For example, even by the New Testament times, you'd go to the synagogue and they read the law every Sabbath. Not every person had a copy of a scroll for themselves. They would have sections of scrolls, but the king, verse 18, needs to have a copy of this book for himself so he can read it for himself. He's the leader of the people. He's not just a political leader. He's not a military leader. He's supposed to be their spiritual leader. So he needs a copy of the law. He needs to read that law, all right? So number one, he needs to have his own copy. Number two, look at verse 19. And it shall be with him that he shall read it all the days of his life. So he needs to read it regularly. He doesn't just need to say, well, I've read that. I read that scroll. I read over in Isaiah. I read that part. I read Moses one time. But he needs to read Moses, and needs to read Moses, and he needs to read Moses, and he needs to read Moses, and he needs to read the prophets. He needs to read the scrolls. He's going to spend some time with it. So he's going to own his own copy. He's going to read it regularly. And then here's the result. Let's list five. They are to learn to fear the Lord his God. If he spends time in the Word, reading through the scrolls, he will learn to fear his God. More about that in a moment. What else will he learn? He should carefully obey. He's going to learn, get that from reading the law. You reckon he'll get that from Deuteronomy? Because Deuteronomy over and over and over says, be careful, be careful, be careful, be careful. He's going to get that from Deuteronomy. And be careful to observe all the words of the law and these statutes. Number three, the word's going to make him humble, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren. If he spends time in the scrolls, he should walk away with some humility, shouldn't he? He reads about the power of God versus his own power. My confidence is not in my power, but in the power of God. And so it should humble him. You think maybe the problem we're seeing as to why Israel went astray is the kings didn't spend time in the scrolls, maybe? Perhaps so. Psalm 78 gives us some insight. All right, what's the next thing? Verse 20. He's not going to turn to the right hand or to the left. In other words, he's not going to turn aside. He's going to stay on the right course because he spent time in the scrolls. And the consequence is also going to be he will prolong his days. I think that has to do with prolonging his days as king. The Lord will bless him. And so he's a good king. He's following the law. God's going to promote him, and he's going to stay in his king. Becomes wicked, then God's going to allow things to happen to him. And they did. Make sense? Any practical things in that? We're not a king. We don't have the scrolls. We have a copy of what was in the scrolls. But you think if we own our own copy of the Word, read it regularly, that we'll learn to fear God and carefully obey and be humble and not turn aside and prolong our days? I think there's a key there. Good point, isn't it? Powerful. All right. We're done with the king now. Let's go to verse 19. Let's talk about fear. One of our questions, which question was that? I have one on fear somewhere. Question number 9, what do you learn about fear from this passage? Well, the only place it's mentioned is in verse... All right. Yes, you're right. Verse 13 and in verse 19, the people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. So here is fear mentioned in those two verses. From verse 19, I learned from that we learn to fear. Just because somebody doesn't fear God doesn't mean they can't learn to fear. And if you do fear God, you learned to fear God. You don't just soak it up somehow by osmosis. Make sense? So the more time we spend with the Word, the more we're going to learn to fear God. The second thing I learned from that is we learn to fear from reading the Word. Show me somebody that doesn't fear God and they're not spending enough time in the Word. Show me somebody that has devoured the Word, and I'll guarantee you they fear God. Make sense? And then I learned from verse 19 that if you fear God, it means you'll be careful to observe all the words of the law. So the king's going to learn from reading the Word to carefully observe all the words of the law. A lot about fear there, isn't it? And then verse 13, you hear and you fear. Questions or comments on fear? Powerful, powerful subject. All right. Questions or comments on chapter 17? We've got to get through 18. All right. Let's get underway with chapter 18. Let's get question number 5. How were the Levites to be provided for? That's not good. That's not good or English, is it? Very good. Excellent. That's exactly right. They'll be provided for by the sacrifice. Let's jump to question 7. Who was the prophet foretold in chapter 18? Jesus, and how do we know? It's not mentioned in this passage. All right. Acts 3, 22 and 23 is the divine interpretation. You want a divine commentary? The best commentary you'll read on Deuteronomy 18 is found in Acts 3. Divine inspiration. All right, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's talk about the Levite portion and work through that, and then we'll get to the heathen practices. That's there's a little new information. Not the concept's not new, but the new information, some of the details it is. What we have here, and I'm just going to quickly notice this because I want to get to the other two points. The Levites have no inheritance. That doesn't mean they don't get anything. It just means when you get into the land, and so the tribe of Judah is going to get their portion, and the tribe of Benjamin gets their portion, and the tribe of half a tribe of Manasseh, and another half a tribe of Manasseh, and the tribe of Reuben. They all get their portion, but there's no portion given to the Levites. They don't have a territory land, but they're going to dwell in among all the others. That's all that verses 1 and 2 is saying. They don't have a portion. They don't have inheritance. So here's what's going to happen. They're going to get provision from the sacrifice of the people. So look at verse 3. And this shall be the priest's due from the people, from those who offer sacrifice, whether it's a bull or sheep, etc. All right. That gets us down through verse 5. Now at verse 6 and 7, this is a little new information, unless I've missed something. When I'm flagging something as new information, I'm just not remembering it. So we may have seen it, and you can flag that for me if you want to. What we learned in 6 to 8? Finish my sentence. A Levite who lives away from the tabernacle can decide, I'm going to sell all my belongings and whatever house I have and... All right, I'm going to go to the place where God chooses. Remember, see that phrase again? It's over and over and over. I'm going to go to the place that God chooses, where the tabernacle is. And I'm going to be and take on full tabernacle service. And he will be provided for by the sacrifices. Where he may have been out here taken care of by other means, he's going to be taken care of by the sacrifice of the people when they come to the place where God chooses. And he'll have equal portion. So, that's all we learned right there. The Levites don't have an inheritance. They're provided for. And then here's kind of an addendum that here's one who decided, I want to be a full-time priest down at the tabernacle. And he goes and he becomes one. And I would take it there's more to it than that. Perhaps that has to be, there's some conjecture that may have had to be approved by the high priest, because what if every Levite moved in? That's not going to work. There had to be some, I'm sure, some discussion perhaps with the high priest. I'll leave that for you to decide. Let's talk about the heathen practices now. That's not a new concept, but the details may be a little bit new to us here in this. Now, I think there's a direct connection between these heathen practices that we'll get to in a moment, and I'll get to it, and this prophet like Moses. I think they're a contrast to each other, and we'll get to that here in just a second. So let's start at verse 9 here. When you come into the land that the Lord's giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of the nations. In other words, they're pagans. They're given to these abominations. Don't listen to that. Don't participate in it. Don't buy into it. Don't be fooled by it. For example, don't make your son or daughter pass through the fire, which has reference to Molech. Offering their children to Molech. Now, whether that one is separate and distinct from all the others that are mentioned in verse 10 and 11, here we have verses 10 and 11 quoted, and then eight things that are mentioned here, that all of those eight seem to have, now there's nine if you include the giving unto Molech. But taking these as separate from that, I'm not thinking that it is equal to the rest of them in what these eight do. And here's what I mean by that. All eight of these seem to have some, let's jump down here to the purpose box. It seemed to focus on learning the divine will, a divine will from their gods, not the God, but from the gods, or learning the future. And how do I know that? Well, look at verse 14. For these nations which you shall you will dispossess, listen to soothsayers and diviners. In other words, they're listening to them seemingly to discern the will of the gods, the divine. They think those are divine. So the divine will. Or to understand something of the future. For example, let's start with number 8, the calling up the dead, the consulting with the dead. It's not saying they can, but the thought was they could consult with the dead and learn what the future life's like. So let's call up the dead and let's talk to this person who's already dead, and he can tell me what the future is. So now I know something about the gods and I know something about the future because I've talked to the dead through these magical arts. So let's talk about some of these. Here's the witchcraft. One translation we use, divination. It seemed to be some manner of trying to discern what the gods want through witchcraft. Soothsayer, an observer of times. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown so translate that. It's an observer of the clouds, an observer of various things, again, discerning the will of God. I'm not sure that I understand all the distinction between a witchcraft and soothsaying, and a sorcerer, and the casting of spells. But they all have to do with some magical arts of the paganistic concept of discerning the will of God. Gods, lowercase g. The enchanter, the third one, or the interpreting of omens. Some suggest that had to do with listening to observing serpents, and as a charmer would have. Some have translated that a charmer, the sorcerer, or it's also translated witch in some translation. Comes from a word from which we get our word pharmacy, and it's the idea perhaps of helping people fight off their enemies with hallucinating drugs. And so here again, they're either trying to cast off, number 2 down here, protect from the enemy or bring blessings or discern the will of God. The gods, again, lowercase g. What's the next one here? The conjuring of spells, the casting of spells. King James uses the word charmer. The mediums had reference to learning the future. The spiritists had to do with consulting the outside world of the gods or the spirits. And then the calling up of the dead we've already discussed. Now, more could be said about each one of those. The spiritists had to do with seeking wisdom, such as what some translate number 7 as a wizard. But I think verse 14 is your key in this context. There seemed to be some discerning of the will of the divine, of gods, again, lowercase g. Does that make sense? Now, I think there's a direct contrast between that and what we're going to see concerning the prophet. We'll get to that in a second. Let's get verse 12 to 14. What does he say in 12 to 14? The reason you don't do that, that is an abomination to the Lord. That is an absolute abomination to the Lord. Because of these abominations, the Lord God drives them out. You shall be blameless. For the nations that you dispossess, listen to the soothsayer. In other words, you listen to God, and I think the direct contrast, why do we need to listen to the prophet, be it Moses or be it Christ? Because they're giving us the divine will of God. So that also is telling me that whatever's going on in 9 through 11 is some means of consulting the divine will. Does that make sense? So I don't know that I need to know the exact distinction between, I'll get it here in a second, between the soothsayer and the medium, or the spiritist and the conjuring of spells, because these are different false ways of trying to discern what God wants us to do. And I don't need to listen to any of them. I don't need to listen to any of them. I need to listen to the prophet of God. Does that make sense? That's what really matters. They're all an abomination. Now let's finish the chapter talking about, this gets us down through verse 22 and ends the chapter. And so we've got time to do this. A prophet like Moses. So God's going to raise up a prophet like unto Moses. So God said that Moses said, God will raise up a prophet like me from your midst, and him you shall hear, according to all that you desired. And notice down at verse 14, that what they have spoken is good. This is what the Lord said concerning the people at Mount Sinai, that a prophet like you from among the brethren, I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak them that, all that I command him. Well, all we learn from that is God's going to raise a prophet like unto Moses. You might want to flag Acts 3, 21 to 23. Here's your divine commentary that identifies Christ as being the fulfillment of that. So who was the prophet like unto Moses? It's the Christ, the Messiah. There's no question. It could be this prophet, could be, here's your divine commentary. We're not going to argue that one. That's it. It's the Christ. It's Jesus. Acts 7 is not as clear identifying, but it quotes the same and makes the application to Christ, Acts 7, 37. And you remember several times in John already, there's a statement, are you that prophet? Are you the prophet? The prophet had reference to the prophet of Deuteronomy 18. There was no doubt about that. Because are you Jeremiah, Elijah, or one of the prophets? But then they ask John if he is the prophet. If you're not one of the prophets, you're not the prophet. It's talking about Deuteronomy 18. So you have that in John 1, John 6, John 7. Make sense? So anytime you come across the prophet and the context doesn't identify it as being Isaiah or Jeremiah, it has reference most likely to Deuteronomy 18. This was the prophet they were looking for. All right, I'll borrow this from Clarence Fell. This is not the only comparison. Moses spoke directly with God. Jesus speaks directly with God. Moses led the people out of captivity of Egypt. Jesus leads out of the captivity of sin. Moses was the lawgiver. Jesus is a lawgiver. Moses was the mediator of the old covenant. Jesus is the mediator of the new covenant. Moses was a prophet of the Old Testament. Jesus is the prophet of the New Testament. On we could go. Parallels. All right, let's get verse 20. While speaking of a prophet, a false prophet should die. You see that at verse 20? He presumes to speak in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak. That prophet shall die. Think there's any connection with that and those who are discerning the divine will through the mediums and the spiritist, etc.? I think there's a connection. I don't think this is an, oh, by the way, let's talk about this prophet and let's jump gears and shift gears and we're going in a different direction. This is threaded directly to those heathen practices. Don't listen to those means of consulting the divine will. You listen to Moses, and ultimately there's the prophecy of the Christ. Listen to him. Yes, sir.
I think there's a connection here to Deuteronomy 4, 2. You shall not add or take away the word.
Exactly. Good point. Good point. Don't add to nor take away. Very good. All right, one more thought in verses 21 and 22. Here's how you know he is a false prophet. Before you put him to death, you need to be sure he's a false prophet. And how do we know? He prophesies something will come to pass, and it doesn't come to pass. He's a false prophet. Do you see a little bit of thread that runs from here back to those mediums and the spiritists? Because they were trying to discern the future, consult with the dead and discern what the future is. They're telling you what the future is. And, all right, if he foretells the future and doesn't come to pass, he's a false prophet. If he's a true prophet, it's going to come to pass just as it was spoken. All right, question number whatever it is, number 10. Practical things, we may have time for a couple. What do you learn from 17 and 18? There are 10 on the board. You can use one of those or make up your own. What do you take home with you? All right, yeah. This idea of somebody reading your palm or looking into the crystal ball going to tell me what the future is? The only one knows the future is God. If he hadn't told me, then I'm not going to know. Yes, sir.
I think it makes you think of Saul when he sought the medium to give his answer of what to do in 1 Samuel 28. And he had already chosen to leave God at that point, and he was seeking answers elsewhere. And why God was so displeased with him is he was going elsewhere and not to him.
Exactly. Doing the very thing that's forbidden right here. Good, good connection. It is. It is. Number 6, as bad as stoning is, you think of how many times in these two chapters the false prophets to be stoned, the idolaters to be stoned. As bad and as terrible as that is, hell is much worse, according to Hebrews chapter 10. He that died under Moses died without mercy. Of how much sore punishment do you suppose he should be thought worthy? That's much worse. Probably a good note to end on. We'll stop right there.